Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. In this episode, we'll feature the first part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams about their book, The Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. But first, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Media critics and women's groups were troubled and angered by a Brooklyn-based Hasidic newspaper this week. The paper digitally removed Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Audrey Thomason of the National Security Council from the iconic photograph of President Obama and staff gathered in the Situation Room during the operation that killed Osama bin Laden. The paper apologized but said its policy is not to publish photographs of women on religious grounds. How women and girls are portrayed in the media has long been a concern, one where no matter how much progress is made, say women in top leadership roles in government, there is always more to do. Independent Television Service, a public media network that funds documentary films, is working on a new initiative to spotlight women and girls as leaders across the world. Called Women and Girls Lead, the program plans to promote 50 documentaries over a three-year span, showcasing women and girls fighting for social justice and equal rights. Tamara Gold, Vice President of ITVS International.
There is a tipping point right now in the public consciousness about the role that women can, will, and must play in conflict resolution, in global gender equity, in economic development, in health.
ITVS is hoping to extend and deepen the life of each film by sharing the content over many different media, from TV to radio to the internet, and from smartphones to video games. They've also teamed up with international and domestic NGOs and other public media partners to help drive a national dialogue about the issues raised in each film.
Documentary filmmakers spend years, they mortgage their houses, they take out loans, they go to tremendous lengths to finance their independent productions. The way it used to be, where one broadcast or a few broadcasts was the most you could expect for your film, those days are really over.
The first film of the initiative aired on PBS's Independent Lens this week. Called Bhutto, the film chronicles the life of the first Muslim woman elected to lead an Islamic nation. Gold is hoping films like Bhutto will have a ripple effect across the globe, firmly securing women and girls as leaders and change makers.
We're not looking just for female audiences. What we're saying is that these stories about our communities and about our mothers, sisters, wives, daughters, and friends elevate us all.
To find out more, visit ITVS.org.
Court's mission. Both parties would like to continue this for 2 weeks to come to an agreement and to finalize.
Does that satisfy you?
Yes?
Yes. Court proceedings are often as mysterious as the TV dramas where most of us get our only contact with them. But a new project called Open Court, launched in Quincy, Massachusetts last week, hopes to make the wheels of justice a bit more accessible to the public. The court's proceedings are now video streamed, and a Wi-Fi network has been set up for journalists and bloggers to post reports and news stories. Joe Spurr is the director of the Open Court Project, funded by the Knight Foundation. He believes the open court system is still an important part of our culture of government transparency.
Courts were put in the center of town for a reason, so justice could be administered in public, but that's not sort of the case anymore. Journalists don't really even have time to go down, never mind the public, unless you have your own case.
Spurr and his colleagues are creating a template for other courts to modernize public access and create new archiving tools. They're working through the many challenges that have emerged, like establishing common sense guidelines to ensure privacy for citizens.
How to continue to allow, for instance, domestic violence victims to come forward, get a restraining order or whatnot. and trying to figure out sticky issues like that, where that's such an important service of the court. But to a significant extent, the public should be aware of that. But we also don't want to scare victims away from being embarrassed or intimidated about, you know, coming forward.
Spurr says that as smartphones and laptops enter the courtrooms across the country, policies and laws will be revamped over the next few years. Spurr hopes the lessons of open court will be used to create good systems that are respectful of individuals and useful to the community.
Before the technology gets to the point where it's very easy, let's try to set up a best case scenario right now in a safe environment and figure out the policy so we can do this right moving forward. So we're just trying to sort of get the ball rolling, doing common sense stuff that seems useful right now.
To watch Open Court, go to opencourt.us. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. We now feature the first part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams about their book, The Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, May 15, 2011. We are joined by Natalie Moore and Lance Williams. They are co-authors of a new book entitled The Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. Natalie and Lance, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Let's start off with a very general question, I guess addressed for both of you. What is the Black Pea Stone Nation for listeners who may be unfamiliar with the group? And why did you write a book about it?
Well, the Black Pea Stone Nation is what most people would refer to as a street gang that we, I think, kind of present in our book, evolve into a street organization that had impact in many aspects, or on many aspects of life in Chicago in general, but particularly in the African-American community. So it evolved from a small street gang that turned into a confederacy of a lot of smaller street gangs into this Almighty Black Pea Stone Nation that ultimately evolved into a group called the El Rukins that then, you know, you might want to say devolved back into the state of a kind of a renegade state of street gangs known today as the Blackstone Nation.
Mm-hmm. And why write a book about it?
It was a book that hadn't been done and a book we wanted to read. There had been a documentary that BET did on mm-hmm. American Gangster on Jeff Ford and the Blackstone Rangers. And I had
Jeff Ford being the founder of what we now refer to as the Black Pea Stone Nation.
Right.
Correct. Okay.
And I had seen Lance on the documentary, and I had been looking at that time for a book on contemporary black street gangs in Chicago and was coming up short. And I contacted Lance, and he said, well, there aren't any books, why don't we write one together?
And so you did.
Yep.
How long did the book take to write?
I would say from idea to bookshelf, it was about 3 years.
I found it peculiar that, especially given so much of scholarship that's been written about, I guess, for lack of a better word, the black experience, that there seemed to be this peculiar gap related to Chicago street gangs / street organizations. Any guesses as to why you think that's the case?
I think there are a few key things. One, to find individuals that had unique backgrounds that would allow them access to their information. Things have been written, scholarly work has been written that generally has more of an academic kind of law enforcement perspective. So you have had criminologists that have done, you know, academic pieces, but they didn't deal with the totality of the Stones as an organization and kind of like merge them with other street gangs in the city of Chicago. So you had a law enforcement perspective of the organizations, but in terms of something that kind of a journalistic kind of merger of academic kind of journalism and reporting, was difficult because getting the story from the street side, in terms of getting the story from those who were members of the organization, was difficult because the organization was very secretive about their affairs. Mm. So I think it took individuals like Natalie and I, who had a reputation, Natalie having a strong reputation as being one of our sensitive journalists who has covered urban affairs, and then myself, who is an academic but has a background doing street outreach with street gangs and have formed relationships with guys that were members of the organizations, to to get them to trust us to the degree that they would share the story with us. So I think that was a key part of us being able to tell the story, our status in the community, having access to the story. And in the past, other people have not had that access.
I read excerpts of the book online. And in the course of reading it, I was kind of astonished to see, although I suppose in retrospect it kind of makes sense, but to me reading it, it was something of a surprise, that you also had gang/street organizations, which nowadays might be considered a phenomenon of black Chicago, also occurring in white Chicago. You make allusion to organizations within the Polish community, the Italian community, the Irish community, predominantly maybe 100% white, that were also involved in these kind of street organization type arrangements. You reference actually former Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley, who himself was part of a group called the Hamburg Club. And I guess that kind of, what I also found kind of interesting was that those groups kind of served as, I guess for lack of a better word, a farm team into the dominant power structure, like the government, maybe other institutions, where for a long time whites basically held sway. But within the black community, that didn't really happen. And so those organizations, I suppose, may have funneled their energy and efforts into trying to build some kind of political power. What do you think about this assessment? Is this, am I on the right track, or is this off base?
I think it's a great observation. And one of the things that we wanted to do with the book is to always provide context in many instances. And so in this instance, there are other gangs in Chicago who maybe weren't called a gang. They were called youth organizations. But, you know, some of those Bridgeport clubs, I say in quotes, were involved in race riots in Chicago.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. It was a farm team. When the research on this started, it was around the time that he was then governor, or maybe he was former, Rob Blagojevich had been arrested. Yes, he hadn't been impeached yet. And I'm reading history about Chicago, and it hits me just how corrupt we are. It goes so far back to Prohibition, and organizations, whether it was the mob or local street gangs or youth clubs, it was all tied to the politics and keeping alcohol in Chicago. That's really the genesis of our corruption.
Wow.
And so you start reading that and you see the bohemian enclaves that are here, you know, Anton Cermak, who was the mayor, he kept the machine oil as well. And then you get someone like Richard J. Daley, who was a member of the Hamburg Club. So fast forward some decades later, there were some stones in the 70s who said, well, why can't Jeff Fort be, he should be a politician. And it would have been the same kind of growth and evolution that we see in the other youth clubs.
Another thing that was pointed out in the book that I found was that it seemed like that the Black Peace Donation and other groups tried to build that power in alliance with other groups as part of larger movements, most notably reference to the Civil Rights Movement and to later on in the maybe later 60s and early 70s, the Black Power Movements. Across the United States. Do you find that connections were drawn particularly well as far as the Black Peace Donation with other groups in these various alliances, or were relations rather frayed? How much of a role did the Black Peace Donation play in these various larger social movements?
Yeah, I think there was always an attempt, particularly during the Civil Rights Movement, as we discuss in the book, to organize these movements, civil rights movement, to organize all aspects of the community, from those that are most marginalized to those who were in positions of power at various levels of institutional power. Mm. So when it comes to the most marginalized, particularly youth organizations, the Stones at that particular time were the most prominent youth organization in communities like Woodlawn. So it was natural for SCLC, when it came here to kind of implement the War on Poverty campaign, to organize young people. And because the Stones had already had established themselves as the premier youth organization, along with the Disciples, you had the Vice Lords from some, you know, a few years prior, but the Stones were kind of central to this because they were in a key location on the South Side in Woodlawn, where a lot of attention was it was placed.
The Disciples and the Vice Lords being
other street gangs,
right,
in Chicago. So, you know, to answer your question, that to a certain degree, there was an attempt to kind of pull the Stones into the movement. The Stones willingly participated, but at the same time, the Stones were still involved in street level activity that would be considered criminal. So on one hand, it may be in the interest of mainstream institutions, SCLC, Operation Breadbasket, other civil rights movements, to kind of have them participate in marches. At the same time, they were kind of held at a distance because of the criminal kind of influence that they brought to their work. I think ultimately then what happens though is as the Black Power movement kicks in, the Stones have an affinity to that concept because it's more in line with their self-identity. However, just like, you know, all movements, the Civil Rights and the Black Power movement kind of, you know, had, you know, ups and downs. And during the down periods of those movements, the Stones veered more towards the street crime and kind of plugged out of the movement. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about the contours of the Black Peace Donation itself. In how many people at its peak were involved? What were the kinds of degrees of involvement of regular activities that it did? Well, let's start with the numbers. I mean, how many people do we know, or maybe this isn't a known question, were involved with the group maybe at its peak?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I think that, you know, the standard number, accepted number among law enforcement agencies is at their peak in the early 70s, maybe somewhere around 5 to 10,000 members. But, you know, that can be argued because it depends on the degree of participation. So you have guys on the fringes, kind of marginalized, it may be a larger number. Some people even say as many as 50,000 at one time. Mm. But, you know, it varies, and I don't think anybody knows specifically how many members.
And part of the problem with maybe assessing a number, I would imagine, is what do you mean by a member? I mean, if it's having had any kind of involvement in any way with the Black Peace Donation, then yeah, you could count yourself as a member.
Right.
But then otherwise, if that seems a rather thin membership criteria, you want to try to maybe adjust that. But then the question is, to what do you adjust that to? How much do you have to be involved to be then counted as a member?
Absolutely.
And then you obviously the number there, you first have to resolve that argument and then try to find out, assuming you've got that threshold in mind, what's the number there? So I imagine because all of that information may be so hazy, a number may never be definitively arrived at.
Correct.
Okay. In the case of a group like the Black Panther Party, I know that they during the time when they were most active, that they had been involved in various efforts that seemed like you would expect something like a contemporary social service agency to do. They helped people find jobs. They helped feed school kids. They helped provide some measure of defense against antagonistic police forces. Things that you would figure would be the kinds of things that you would expect from, I guess, I don't know if the word welfare may be an issue, but it's the closest thing I can think of. Did the Black Peace Donation at all play a role in this, or what was their connection as far as actually helping people on a day-to-day basis?
You have to remember the time. This is the 1960s, tumultuous times in the United States. You have a lot of movement that's going on. And so youth organizations are going to be attracted to that and want to be a part of it. Mm. And so, no, all the things that the Stones did were not gangbanging. They looked at entrepreneurship opportunities. They did do some community organizing. There's a little funny anecdote about Stone's dressing up as Santa Claus for the Head Start program over at First Presbyterian Church in Woodlawn.
Hmm.
So I would say that there was complexity going on within the organization, and it wasn't just hardcore gangbanging all the time. There were other aspects of them.
I'd like to also learn a little bit more about, I guess, the history of the evolution of the Black Peace Donation. It didn't start by that name, and it didn't end by that name. And if you could, one or both can explain a little bit more about how it actually began, what was the point at which it actually changed from the Blackstone Rangers was his original name to the Black Peace Donation, and then changing away from that into something called El Rukit. So a little bit of a history there, please.
Yeah, I think in the early 60s, the origin of the organization and its name, the Blackstone Rangers, comes from the fact that they, as a small group of guys led by Jeff Ford and Mr. Eugene Bull Harrison, kind of hung out on Blackstone Street,
mm-hmm.
between 64th and 67th on Blackstone Street. So they were known for being in that area. And they also were, as we were told by a gentleman by the name of Usini Perkins, who used to work in at the Boys Club, who worked with Jeff and some of his peers as they participated in activities at the Boys Club, were in the age group of the Rangers. And so because they had the reputation and were involved in kind of antisocial behavior, they were put out of the Boys Club. And according to Usini, they took the name with them, so they become the Blackstone Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is in the early 60s. By 68, Bull got caught up a case, was incarcerated for the solicitation of murder. By the end of 68, he was really the primary leader of the older guys in the street organization. And once Bull got locked up in late 68, that left Jeff as the kind of vice president, so to speak, of the Blackstone Rangers, kind of in a position to be the sole leader on the street. And there was some pushback from the older guys in the organization who didn't necessarily want to follow Jeff's leadership. He was younger. They felt that Bull was their leader and they'd have to listen to Jeff. And there was some internal conflict, which caused Jeff then to reorganize the organization under his sole leadership and call the organization now the Almighty Black Peace Donation. And the P in Black Peace Donation, I should say, makes reference to his name, because he was known as the Black Prince. Bull was the king, King Bull, Jeff was the prince. So he's now asserting himself as the new leader, saying that this is my organization. The older guys kind of continue on as Blackstone Rangers. He ends up going to jail, when he gets out in 76, has a transformation, and his own identity is attracted to the teachings of the Morris Science Temple of America. So he uses those teachings to take the Almighty Black Peace Donation into a more religious Islamic direction, changes the name of the organization to the El Rukin Nation. However, it was during that time and that era that they caught a domestic terrorism case, and the leadership of the El Rukins was wiped out essentially through this war on drugs, and leaders are locked up, and the organization kind of devolves back into the Blackstone Black Peace Donation that it was prior to the El Rukin era.
There was also, I guess, at some point during its history, and I'd like to hear some kind of clarification on this, and maybe if I'm getting the details wrong, let me know, that it seemed that the Black Peace Donation also served as some kind of conduit for federal anti-poverty dollars. Is this the case? Is this true? And can you elaborate?
Yes. I don't know if conduit is the word, but they were recipients.
Okay, recipient then.
In the 1960s, we have the war on poverty going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government trying to figure out what to do with the Negro youth problem.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, you have the Stones and the Disciples who are killing each other on the streets on a regular basis. The Woodlawn organization, the venerable organization that's still around today, it hadn't been around that long back then, and it was led by Arthur Brazier, who was then Reverend Brazier. They were the fiscal agent for those education dollars. And it was $927,000. And that'd be a lot of money today. Yep. So it was a lot of money in 1967. And this money was supposed to go to job training programs and really giving an alternative to the Stones and Disciples so they wouldn't be killing each other and wrecking havoc in Woodlawn. Mm. And what happened is that the program was good in intent, but the facilitation was terrible. You had fraud that went on. You had high school dropouts teaching other high school dropouts. There wasn't much oversight. And what ended up happening, and Richard J. Daley was very opposed to this program, mostly because he didn't want any money coming in that he wasn't having any control over or having any input on. Secondly, law enforcement didn't believe in any social programs for the gangs. They thought you just got to lock them up and deal with them. Anything that's to rehabilitate or do any social programs is just wrong. So, you know, the program played into the hands of its enemies. Then you have the McClellan hearings, the Senate hearings going on in Washington, D.C., and Jeff Fort was brought in to testify.
And when was this?
This was in the late 60s.
Okay.
And he ended up not testifying, being held in contempt. The McClellan hearings were hearings about cities around the country to find out why in the world are black people rioting? Why is there so much unrest going on mm-hmm. in the United States? And then they got wind of these dollars and were like, hold on, how did this happen? And Jeff Fort ended up going to prison for it in the early 1970s for defrauding that program.
How long was he in jail? Or is he still in jail?
No, he had a few stints in prison. So when he went in, that's when he came out in 1976 and changed the orientation toward an Islamic one with the Elrukins.
That was the first part of a two-part interview with Natalie Moore and Lance Williams, recorded on May 15, 2011. More information about the book is available online at www.blackstonebook.com. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.